This is London Calling. Sir John Reith, the Director General of the BBC.
For some time we shall transmit comparatively simple programs. The programs will neither be very interesting nor very good.
That is how the BBC's Empire Service was launched this week in 1932. The Empire Service produced radio shows in Britain for people to listen to in other parts of the world. So basically, it was the prototype of this show 84 years ago. And while we're in the mood for looking back, the top five guests on London Calling from 2016. Based on your votes on Twitter, find out who was the guest of the year. But first, let's have a look at what's happening in Britain. Front page news over Christmas here was that the Queen caught a cold. I'm not joking. The lead story on Christmas Day was that the Queen missed church because she had a cold. We all laugh at North Korea reporting trivia about their head of state as actual news. Well, we're just as silly here in merry old Britain. I'm Graham Mack with this week's Transatlantic Radio programme. Badger, you regularly make trips to the USA, and on one of them you had an amazing experience. What happened?
I was going to San Antonio, so right. I was flying from Heathrow, and I got on a tube train. This woman with her grandchild was getting on, and she was struggling with the bag.
Right.
The luggage. I helped him onto the tube train, so we've ended up going to Heathrow together.
Yeah.
I thought, well, that's pretty young, isn't it? I got on the plane, when I sat down, they were only sitting next to me.
What are the chances of that?
Yeah, they were sitting right next to me. I went, oh, hello. Sorry.
That is, of all the flights going from one of the world's busiest airports, not only were they on the same flight, they were right next to you.
When I helped them onto the tube train, yeah?
Yeah.
With their luggage and
yeah.
that. And, I mean, not only going to the same airport, not only going to the same country, but sitting in the seat next to me.
Incredible. Badger, thank you so much. And if you've got a story of an amazing coincidence, let me know about it. I might put you on the show. You can email me, graham@macmedia.co.uk. Let's go to Antarctica now, where a bloke called Rob Smith, with three other blokes, is on his way to the South Pole. Rob's a cancer survivor. He's also lost his mum and his best friend to the disease. He's raising money for Cancer Research UK. Rob, good to talk to you.
Good to speak to you again.
Now, when we left off last week, you were heading up to the top of a glacier, am I right?
That's correct.
Did you get to the top? Because you were hoping to get to the top by this time.
Yes, we certainly have. So we've made a bit of history with the first people ever to ski up through the Reedy Glacier. So we've reached the top and we're now on the Antarctic Plateau.
So tell me about the view.
Oh, it was absolutely spectacular. I mean, when we got to the top of the Reedy, we turned round and you could just see the mountains opening up and the valley running down with the glacier spilling through. It was absolutely spectacular. So I've managed to get some pictures up onto website if anyone wants to look.
Yeah, where did we find
absolutely
those?
Incredible view. So www.trek2poles.com. That's T-R-E-K, the number two, poles.com.
Trek2poles.com, and it's number two. Okay, oh, we'll check those out. We'll check those out. Now, how is the ankle holding up? You had a twisted ankle.
Yes, it is actually. I'm a lot better. I'm out of pain now. It's good. Skiing really well, really strong. The team's doing fantastically.
And the team that is you with Eric Phillips and Keith Tuffley. You're all getting on okay.
Absolutely, yes. Obviously, two Australians and a Brit, but we're getting on famously. It's fantastic.
Okay, so what's the temperature been? Do you have a way of measuring that?
Yes, we do. The temperature is actually a balmy minus 20.
Minus 20.
And then you've got to add, we've been having a gale that's been blowing. You may be able to hear it, the chain slapping, as we speak. The gale's quite strong and gusts of, 35 odd knots. So we've got a wind chill factor of about minus 51 degrees here.
Wow. Well, to give people an idea, just minus 20, that's colder than your freezer at home. Your freezer at home is usually about minus 18. So you're at minus 20, but then with the wind chill, jeez, wow.
So, it's certainly a position where you don't want any extremities exposed.
Yeah.
Because you will lose them.
So the entire journey from where you were dropped off to the South Pole, 630 kilometres, how far are you in?
So, to date, we've travelled around 250 kilometres. And if we look at what's left as a path, three flies to the South Pole, we've got 367 kilometres to go.
So you're not quite halfway yet. So when do you expect to reach the South Pole?
At this rate, if we have no interruptions, then there is a chance that we could even get there on the 7th of January. But we've still got to keep going 20 kilometres at least a day.
Yeah. And so far, so good then. You're on target. You're on schedule?
Yes, absolutely. It's some days have been quite tough. These gales up on the plateau, when we've come out of the reading, which is quite sheltered, in fact, and get katabatic winds, which is caused by gravity pulling down the winds through the glacier. But when you get up to the plateau where we are now, they're fully exposed. So you have the full gale coming at you, usually in our face as we go. But no, so far, so good. We've managed 20 kilometres.
All right. Well, let's talk about the fundraising aspect of this now, because that's very important before I let you go, because you're doing this for a very important cause, for Cancer Research UK. How do we donate money?
So if you go to my website, which is trekdpoles.com, then you can click on the fundraising tab, and there is a link there to my Just Giving page. Just click on that, and you can donate. That would be fantastic.
I also found out that
really
if you just Google Rob Smith and South Pole, you pretty much go straight to the Just Giving page as well. So if you can't remember the website address, Rob Smith,
fantastic.
South Pole, if you Google it, it's the first one that comes up, Rob. I checked it last week.
Oh, that's excellent. And, it's one of those things. I'm doing this at Cancer Research UK. I really want to push the fundraising.
Yeah.
I've got some way to reach my target, £50,000.
Yeah.
So also, all of your listeners, if there's anyone that can donate, that would be fantastic.
You've done all right so far. I checked, you were over 7,000 last time I checked, £7,000. But you've got your target's 50, isn't it? 50 grand.
That's right, yes.
Let's hope we can do it. Rob Smith, please stay safe. I hope you and Eric and Keith make it on time. And when we talk to you next week, where will you be?
We'll be just further along the plateau. So for the next 20 days, we've got a fairly consistent view, which is long, flat plains of ice. We lose the mountains, we lose everything. It's just the three of us, the sky and the ice. I'll be further along, but same views outside.
Rob Smith, thank you so much. I'll talk to you next week.
Thanks very much, Graham.
Let's get into the top five guests of the year, as voted for by you on Twitter, and find out who the guest of the year is. At number five, it's the star of America's Got Talent, the Las Vegas magician, who's originally from the UK, Piff the Magic Dragon. Piff's not only been appearing in Vegas, he's been touring throughout the United States and Canada, and he got into a bit of bother in Edmonton. I asked him what happened.
We did a radio interview in the morning, and so the night before, Mr. Piffles, my magic performing chihuahua, he got ill, and so he couldn't attend this radio show.
Yeah.
I went in my human disguise because my regular dragon skin had been locked in the comedy club the night before.
Mm-hmm.
And the DJ was very angry about that.
Oh.
And he asked me beforehand, he said to me, so what can I ask you about? And I said, well, I've just did America's Got Talent. I opened for Mumford & Sons. I've performed all over the world and da, 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 you know, gave him some like nice talking points.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, have you seen much of Edmonton? I was like, actually, you know what? We've literally just got here and we haven't had time to do anything other than go to the comedy club, do shows and go to bed. And last night, you know, I had like 4 hours sleep or something. So I was like, you know, and I was working till 3 a.m. last night and we're here, you know, happy to be here, but we haven't, I just don't, haven't seen anything. So the interview starts and he's like, so tell me about Edmonton. And I was like, want to hear about anything else? He's like, no, tell me about Edmonton. I was like, oh, well, actually, I've only seen the mall because that's, you know, we're in the big shopping mall. That's all I've seen. He said, okay, well, what's your favorite thing in the mall? And I was like, well, I've got the pirate ship. I don't really know what to tell you right now. It's very early. I'm tired. I have no idea. I'm not prepared for this conversation. It went downhill from there rapidly. And he finished the interview after like 5 minutes. And, you know, he's very polite. He said, oh, thanks. Goodbye. And I said, okay, thank you. And then I arrived at the gig later that night and Twitter was full of angry people. You know, he didn't know anything about me other than his 5 minutes. And what happened was, when I left the studio, he got back on the microphone and was like, Piff the Magic Dragon, he hates Edmonton. He said to me he hates, didn't want to be here, and then just sort of like was very mean to me without me being there to defend myself. And so he like sort of the stuff. And you know, it was funny because the club manager was actually with me and so obviously knew it wasn't real. And you know, just sometimes these DJs, they like to make a bit of controversy. And that was a good example of that. So, and we're actually going back to Edmonton next week. I mean, we just suffocated him with kindness. We like sent him a poster for his daughter, who was a big fan. And but I don't think we're going to be doing that radio show. So yeah, it wasn't the people of Edmonton, more like a person of Edmonton.
Did he give you that old line about like my daughter's a big fan, which means he's not saying
not on air?
Oh, I see.
Not on air.
Right. Okay.
Beforehand.
Yeah.
And he did say that. He's like my daughter's a big fan, as if that offended him more.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, before we went on, I was like, this is not going to go well.
No.
But yeah, I mean, when it started, I was like, oh god, this is not good. yeah, I think he was very upset that his daughter liked the show.
Well, let's go back to the beginning, because before you inhabited the personality of Piff the Magic Dragon, you were John van der Put.
Yeah.
Where did you grow up?
Southeast London, in this place called Forest Hill, on a rope park around there, which is, it's near Lewisham, I guess.
Yeah. And what did you do when you left school? What was your first gig?
Well, I went to university.
Yeah.
When I was at university, I did magic to earn a living, because that was just at the time that the grants got cut.
Right.
So I think student loans had just come in. So, you know, I was doing magic to earn a living there, and I thought, well, this is more fun than what I was supposed to be doing. So when I left university, I sort of carried on doing that.
And what kind of magic was that?
Close-up magic.
Right.
It was all close-up magic. And like, you know, there's obviously a part of magic that's show business,
yeah.
But it's not a very big part of magic. A lot of magic is corporate events and weddings and bar mitzvahs and, you know, private parties. And I was terrible at that because I just got this grumpy face, you know, I've just got that sort of like natural grumpy disposition. Even when I'm happy, people are like, what's wrong? I'm like, nothing, I'm happy.
Were you really called the Eeyore of close-up magic?
Yeah, I did a wedding and somebody was very angry. They didn't say that lightly. They were very upset that I was so miserable at their wedding. And I was like, I'm not. And the guy was like, you're like the Eeyore of magic. Stormed away. So, you know, and I would make jokes and people would just take them too seriously. You know, I would like insult somebody or whatever and they would get all offended. It sort of wasn't, you know, I was good at the magic. I was technically good at the magic, but obviously appalling at the people skills required to be a close-up magician. And then I was sort of on the verge of going, okay, well, I'm not really enjoying my life. I would rather do something else. And I went to a party. It was a costume party, a fancy dress party, and I went as a dragon. It was my sister had a dragon outfit under her bed. No one else was in costume. It was just me.
Oh, it was one of those. Had you been set up, or was it just an accident? Just people decided not to.
It was just an accident.
Right.
It's just people didn't go, and then the host of the party, it was her house, so she just changed, and it was just me in a dragon outfit. I was like, what am I doing here? And then a friend of mine came up to me. She said, you know, you could do this in your act. You could be Puff the Magic Dragon. And I was like, wait, I could be Piff the Magic Dragon. You might have heard of my older brother, Steve. So I did that and I tried it out and it killed from the first time.
And Piff the Magic Dragon was born.
Yeah, and I just think, you know, something about my grumpy little face and a dragon outfit, which, because, you know, before people were like, no, you're just a, you know, you're just a bit of an idiot. Whereas now it's like, oh, now you're an idiot in a dragon outfit. This is hilarious.
At number four in the countdown of Guest of the Year, it's Suzi Quatro, singer, songwriter, multi-instrumentalist. I sat down in her kitchen in a rockstar mansion in Essex. She told me all about her life and her career. She started out playing in a band with her sisters, and she told me about the time her dad punched Chuck Berry.
We were in Buffalo, New York, and we were obviously supporting Chuck Berry. He was on after us. And one of the girls, long blonde hair and quite big-chested. And anyway, we were watching, and then we went back in the dressing room, and Chuck Berry came off the stage from his show. And he was only honestly fooling around. He was fooling around. He didn't mean anything. He grabbed the blonde, and he was playing and threw her on the couch messing around. And my dad happened to walk in at that point.
Yeah.
So he just went, wallop. I said, Dad, you just knocked out Chuck Berry.
What was Chuck's reaction?
Well, he was a bit shocked, but he didn't do anything. He just got up and walked into his room. He didn't say anything, but I saw him years later in Munich.
Yeah.
And I went backstage and I said, hi. And he said, hi. He knew who I was. And then he put it together because I saw him looking. He must have followed a little bit, you know, known that. And I said, do you remember Buffalo, New York, 1967? He said, immediately went, yes. Remember the pledges? Because he went, yes. I said, remember my dad hitting you? He said, yes. Oh, God. No, he was fine. He was fine. He said, I won't forget that.
So, now you talk about this in your book, and it's okay if you don't want to talk about it here. I only bring it up because it was in the book. When you were 17, you fell in love with a married man. At 18, you're pregnant, and you had an abortion.
Yeah, scared shitless I was, actually. Yeah.
But a big decision to make that young.
Huge. Huge.
Why did you decide the timing?
Yeah, and I'm a Catholic girl, and, you know, yeah, I'm a Catholic girl, and I'm really strong on my beliefs, but I was scared. I didn't think about it at that time. I just thought, get rid of it, until a little bit later, and now it's something I carry the stigma of that on me forever. I can only put it down to fear. Just fear. What am I going to do? What am I going to do? I was petrified. But it's not a nice feeling. I feel sorry for any woman who has to make that decision. I don't think it's anything you ever get over. And then when you have kids, all you ever think about is who that would have been. It's not easy. But when you're, it's not. I'm not the first girl to have done that at that age. You know, I got caught. He was married. And I made the decision. Not happily. Not happily.
At number three, it's a bloke whose life was turned into a Hollywood movie in 2016, the British ski jumper Eddie the Eagle. I talked to him on the phone from his home in Gloucestershire and asked him about how his life changed after the 1988 Winter Olympics in Calgary.
I went from a plasterer earning about £6,000 a year to Eddie the Eagle earning £10,000 an hour.
But 4 years after the Olympics, you declared bankrupt. What happened?
Well, all my money that I was earning was going into a trust because I was still an amateur sportsman. And in the Olympics, you had to be amateur to go into Olympics. And so all the money that I was earning was going into a trust. And I had three trustees there to look after my money. And unfortunately, through alleged mismanagement and, you know, negligence, they lost a lot of my money. I had to go into bankruptcy, and, you know, I was allowed to, you know, take my trustees to court, and I got some of my money back at the end of the day, and I managed to buy a property. So, it was tough times. That was in 1991, 92, I think, somewhere around there.
And you went back to school as well. You studied law at De Montfort University in Leicester.
That's right. And that was because of my legal team and the way they put my case together. It was really, really interesting. So after I tried to go for the 1998 Olympics in Nagano, hadn't qualified. So I came home and went back to studying. I did some GCSEs through distance learning. Then I did an A-level through distance learning. And then I decided to go to De Montfort University in Leicester and study law. And it was all because of my bankruptcy and and what happened there. And I loved it. I loved being a student. I loved studying law. It was a great 3 years of my life. And, you know, I still think now maybe I'll do another degree, but I did it just before they started charging for degrees. And nowadays, I think being 18 or 27, 30,000 pounds in debt at the end of a degree is kind of putting me off a little bit.
And Eddie the Eagle, the film, was a huge worldwide hit. You must have made some money out of that, didn't you?
I did, yes. Well, I signed the deal to make this film 17 years ago. It's been a long time coming. It was only because I did Splash and I won the first series of Splash that Dexter Fletcher saw me in Splash in the final.
And that was, for anyone that doesn't know, that was a reality TV show where celebrities, they dive.
That's right, yeah. They were teaching celebrities to dive, springboard dive. I won the series, and Dexter saw me. He was the director in the film, thought there's a story there. Then he'd heard that I'd signed these rights to a movie 17 years previously. So he managed to get Matthew Vaughn to buy them, and then they made the film. It was incredible. And yes, I did get quite a bit of money, but unfortunately, that had to go in my divorce. So got it in one hand, and then it was taken away in the other.
You talk about your divorce. The marriage didn't work out, but you met your wife while you were working as a radio presenter. Where you lowered yourself to work as a radio presenter. Where was that?
Just as I was starting my degree in 2000 in Leicester, the BBC local radio station asked me if I would be a guest DJ. I used to do a request programme on a Sunday morning. So every weekend, I used to come back to Gloucestershire to do a request programme on a Sunday morning for BBC Radio Gloucestershire. And then Monday to Friday, I'd be in Leicester doing my law degree. And then I met my wife, now my ex-wife, and we got married as soon as I finished my law degree. We went to Vegas and got married, had two little girls, and then unfortunately we got divorced about 2 years ago.
Well, this year, the Daily Mirror newspaper reported that Eddie the Eagle is living in a garden shed, surviving on egg sandwiches after being, and their quote is, wiped out by his wife. How much truth is there in that story?
There is quite a bit of truth in that story. The living in a shed bit is a little bit old because I was living in a shed up till about a year ago. But I'm not living in the shed at the moment. But I am living in the house that I've got, but it is in a serious state of disrepair. I'm slowly renovating the house. But luckily enough, I'm not in the house very much anyway because I'm travelling a lot doing promotional work. So I don't have to live in it all the time. I've got no walls, no ceilings. I've only just put a bathroom in and things like that. I mean, it's comfortable enough, but it's one of those things I'm doing slowly over the next couple of years. And I hope to, you know, be in a lot better position, hopefully by the middle of next year, and get the house, you know, finished and living comfortably. So that part is slightly old news. I'm still living off egg sandwiches. I still love my egg sandwiches because I haven't got a kitchen. So I've got a little camper stove and I'm able to boil water. So I have water for a kettle, for a cup of tea, and I boil water for some boiled eggs and that kind of thing. But, you know, when I'm doing dinners and speaking at dinners, I'm eating good meals there anyway. So I don't mind when I'm home if I'm only living off egg sandwiches because, you know, usually sometime in the week I'm going to do an after-dinner speech or a motivational talk and go to a dinner and then I can eat, you know, proper food. It's a bit tough, but I'm, you know, living okay.
Sounds to me like you've beaten bigger odds, Eddie. I think you'll be
fine.
Well,
that's right. That's right. You know, when you've been living in a camper van and travelling around Europe and scraping food out of bins, you know, the way I'm living now is luxury compared to that. And because I've done that before and, you know, I'm quite happy to do it again. It's what I know. It's what I love doing. I love being active and, you know, doing my building work. I come from a long line of builders and plasterers and, you know, I prefer to put my money into that than put it into the stock market.
At number two, it's the actor, author and director Richard E. Grant. You've seen him in over 80 films and television programmes, including With Nail and I, The Scarlet Pimpernel, Jack and Sarah, LA Story, Dracula, Hound of the Baskervilles, Gosford Park, The Iron Lady and Downton Abbey. He was born in Swaziland. When I spoke to him, he just launched his third fragrance, which was called Jack Piccadilly 69. I asked him why he called it that.
Piccadilly Circus in 1969 was a sort of zeitgeist moment for me in that it was the year that they landed on the moon. So all things American were so exotic. It was the end of the 60s. I just came on a visit when I was 12 years old with my parents in May and came out of Piccadilly Circus tube station, and the whole of Eros statue and fountain was literally covered in hippies, and the smell of patchouli oil was overwhelming. They then took me to see Hair, in which I saw Elaine Page's Minge full frontal, unbeknownst. I didn't know that she was Elaine Page then. I now know her very well, not in that sense, but so I saw Hair, went to Fortnum and Mason, had Earl Grey tea, the base of which is bergamot. They had leather seating. There's petrol fumes all the way down Piccadilly, which I love. So I put petrol, patchouli, bergamot, which is the base of Earl Grey tea, and leather all into this perfume. So it's an homage to that year. And it's also the year that the first film that I was ever in with Neil and I was set. So, and as I wore patchouli oil while I was making the film, you know, in homage to the character that I was playing, it's all of those things. That's the background story of why that's in. So basically it's sex in a bottle. I saw see-through clothes in Soho for the first time. And so it was a hormonal rocket storm for me. So it's in homage to that. And of course, 69 is a sexual position, which you know about. If you read The Joy of Sex cover to cover, as I had when I was a teenager, you will know that 69 features prominently.
So as you smell it today, does it take you right back to that time?
Instantaneously, because smell is the shortest synaptic leap in the brain between to your memory. If you haven't smelled something for X number of years and you smell it, you don't even need to think about where you were. You are instantly transported back to that moment you first smelt that smell.
Can we go back to the very beginning then? You're born in Swaziland, you grew up there. You actually grew up in a world without television.
Yeah, they got television in 1980, and I'd already left by then. I'd gone to university, so there was no TV. There was a BBC World Service, so I grew up on Round the Horn and Kenneth Williams's bizarre voice, or so it seems. I didn't know what he looked like, and Just a Minute and all those things.
And when you were 10 years old, there was a defining moment in your life.
Yeah, I woke up on the back seat of a car and wasn't obviously supposed to wake up. And I inadvertently witnessed my mother shagging my father's best friend on the front seat. So that's when I began. I tried God for sort of advice or solace, didn't get an answer. So I began keeping a diary because I couldn't tell anybody about it. And so I've been a lifelong diarist ever since. And then out of those diaries then wrote and directed an autobiographical film about starting with that scene called Wawa, which I made 12 years ago.
What was that experience like then as an actor to suddenly turn director, but the first one you direct, you're directing your own life?
Well, the advantage of that is that you are a middle-aged man post-psychoanalysis who has, you know, got all the ducks in a row or squared the circle, whatever it is, and come to terms with what happened when I was a child. So unlike being a child where you have no control over what adults are doing, going back in middle age and directing people to do all these scenes was great therapy. And of course, I was in total control of it. The painful part of it and the catharsis of it took during the writing of the screenplay and its many drafts, but the actual directing of it was probably the most creative and enjoyable experiences I've ever had. So it was all turned out good.
Richard E. Grant, who spoke to me from his home on the other side of London via Skype, you voted him number 2 on my list of the top 5 guests of 2016. But the number 1 guest, according to you, was the comedy legend, writer and actor, John Cleese. I got to speak to him in his office in Chelsea. On a very warm day, we had the window open in the office and you can hear the London traffic going by, making it sound even more London-y. Earlier in the year, John had fallen out with the British journalist and former CNN presenter, Piers Morgan. So I asked him, what is it about Piers that winds you up so much?
I had no intention of making rude remarks about him, although I've always thought that he had a kind of slimy, self-advertising personality not combined with any noticeable talent at all. And the fact that there are people like this around who can become so successful, I think, is just because the value system has collapsed. But he when he came back, he was given a column in the Mail on Sunday, and he took the opportunity in this column to relate an event that had happened. And I'd been in an incredible restaurant, Ralph Lauren in New York. I had the best steak I've ever had. I was with a wonderful old girlfriend that I'd met in the 80s. And we've always stayed good friends. She works as a film producer. And I was with my agent, and I looked up and I suddenly thought, oh no. Because there was Piers Morgan. If there's anyone I never wanted to meet, it was Piers Morgan. And so I just pretended I hadn't seen him, and I just talked to my friends. And at the end, I sort of got up and squeezed out through the table by chance, not seeing him. And about a few weeks later, he wrote a very attacking piece about me, saying that our eyes had met and there was mutual loathing. Complete rubbish. Because, you know, he's a journalist. He's a British journalist.
Yeah.
You know, and so I put him down pretty effectively. People thought that that I won that one, like knockout the third round, you know.
Did you ever make up with Taylor Swift after you insulted her cat at the Graham Norton show?
Oh, I think there was a lot of humour there. I mean, I thought she was wonderful. I'm so ignorant about music that I'd never heard of her. And I apologise if it upsets people, but I'm not interested in 98% of modern music. I went on the show with her, and I thought, oh dear, I'll be trying to figure out her deep South accent. There'll be a Tennessee twang. And she sat down, and she's one of the most utterly beguiling creatures I've ever seen. I mean, she's very pretty and smart as a whip, but there's also a quiet, calm, demure quality about her when she's saying slightly wicked things. I mean, at one point I was talking about cats, and I made fun of her cats because she has Scottish folds and they've got their ears folded over, and I said, well, what sort of an accident did they have, you see? And I don't think she was offended. At least
okay.
I thought she didn't understand a little bit.
I think you said it's not a proper cat.
Well, I said that, yes. And I teased her about cats. At one point, I remember, I said, but I love cats. I said, they're kind of wonderful, cool, and unpredictable. And I said, they're like women. She said very quietly, let's not even go there.
And how are your cats? Because I'm a cat person. We've got two
wonderful
cats.
I've just left our four cats to walk over here to talk to you.
And did you really? I looked on your Twitter. Did you really have to move out so you could have the house renovated for the cats?
Well, we're having a lot of cat work done. We're having some cat walks put in along the walls. I don't quite understand them, but it means basically the cats can stroll around up and down and on the walls.
So like shelves, really?
Like shelves, yeah. Like shelves, but it's a catwalk. And, of course, the builders have not quite finished
but
yet.
But it must have been a big job. You had to move out.
Oh, yes. Well, we've also we made two small rooms that were both a bit dark. And we've been living there for 6 years, but I finally had the money to say, let's do this properly. And instead of two small dark rooms, we now have a really large, bright room. And it's fabulous. So we'll be in there tomorrow evening. And the cats are not arriving until Saturday morning. They're spending a night with our wonderful Filipino housekeeper. She just looks after them. And when we go away, she moves into our flat and lives in our flat with the cats.
And that's what will happen when you go on tour with Eric.
So yes.
Again.
Absolutely.
Tell us about this show then. It's Eric Idle and John Cleese. Or is it John Cleese and Eric? How did you decide the billing for a show?
I don't remember. I don't think we ever talked about it. I think it's alphabetic.
Yeah, it is.
Alphabetic. It always was with Python. It was Chapman, Cleese, Idle, Palin. Oh, no, Jones. Idle, Jones, Palin. And what was the other one? Oh, Gilliam. Well, he doesn't count anymore. I tell you exactly how it happened. It happened because I was promoting the autobiography, which is called So Anyway.
Which is hilarious.
I think it's hilarious.
Hilarious.
And I've just done the audiobook version of
Great.
And I think people, or some people who read the book and didn't think it was very funny.
Who didn't think it was very funny?
Lots of people. It was a really nice doctor.
There were dark and thoughtful things in there, but it's an autobiography, so it has to be...
That's right. Yeah, but don't forget what the Daily Mail said about it. Do you remember what they said?
Self-indulgence or something?
Self-obsessed.
Self-obsessed.
My daughter said, isn't that the point of an autobiography? But the Daily Mail is so much out to put it down that they hired a professor who said quite a lot of nasty things about how selfish and, you know, just all that usual Daily Mail stuff. But they wanted it to be kind of authoritative so that they got a professor to do this now. Guess what he was a professor of?
What?
Criminology.
Why?
Because he was prepared to write a nasty review, and he had a professor, or they could put professor, they'd give the nasty review a little bit. This is the kind of crap we get from the daily papers in England most of the time. It's not just the Mail. The Mail's just the nastiest and the most utterly aimless. But there's a nasty side to the Telegraph and to all of them, really. They're all a very dodgy lot. And I want to clean them up because I don't think you can have a proper democracy if there isn't good information out there.
The book goes from your birth up until the beginning of Python and then jumps to the O2 shows.
That's right.
So there's still a lot to cover.
Oh, it's masses. I don't know
how many.
So how many
more books are you going to be...
I don't know. I think I'll try and get most of it in the next one, because a lot of the early stuff, I thought, if people wanted to understand my mind and my upbringing and the sort of humour I do, and people who like my humour like to understand it, you know, people love getting behind the scenes and discovering how things work, why people do things. They never used to 40 years ago, but they do now. I just thought to myself, I think I've got a lot of material, and I wanted it to be funny, and I wrote, I think, some very funny stuff. And I was planning to finish at the beginning of Monty Python. And then, after I'd been working on it a year, the Pythons got together and said they were going to do the O2. Well, you can't then not mention it.
Yeah.
So I did a shortest chapter linking the O2 and pointing out how utterly different it was from the television series.
In what way?
Well, did you know this is a lot of singing and dancing?
Yes, there is. And you're not a singer and dancer, although you originally toured with a musical in the US.
Yeah, but I was so bad that the musical director wouldn't let me sing. And he's right. I'm a terrible...
Yeah, to
but Python, at the beginning, there was no music and dancing in Python at all.
No.
But Eric was...
With
smart.
The exception of maybe the Lumberjack song?
Well,
maybe?
There's an occasional funny song, but yeah. I mean, at the O2, I suspect something like 35-40% of it was singing and dancing. And Eric, thank God, did that. Because in a 16,000-seat arena, if you're just doing two-hander sketches, you can do it now and a few here and there, but if you just did them back-to-back, it just wouldn't fill the hall. You know what I mean? It would just be too small and... itsy-bitsy. But by having Eric do the whole show, and he basically put it together because the rest of us were busy, and he's so rich now with all his money from Spamalot. Envy.
He's got the experience from Spamalot.
Exactly.
As well, to be fair.
He's been playing and doing in the world of musicals for 10 years, and he had an experience I would have given my right arm for, which is he worked with Mike Nichols, who I think is the greatest genius of my lifetime in that kind of era, especially in comedy. And so he knew how to fill the stage out, and he brought in Arlene Phillips, who'd done the choreography and Meaning of Life and that kind of thing, and John Dupre, who'd done the lyrics with him for Spamalot, and John wrote the music for Fish Called Wanda, which nobody realizes.
Really?
So he's been around with us for many, many years. And he filled it out with these dance numbers. But if you go out to the original television shows, it was none of that at all. So it just shows that there were other aspects of Python. And Eric was always the musically gifted one. And just in the early shows, because there was so little music, that what didn't have quite such a chance to shine.
Mm. Are you surprised at how broad the appeal of Python is? Because
astonished.
I'll give you an example. When I look at Python, it's very British.
Yes.
It's very middle class.
Very.
It's Oxbridge.
Yes.
Which is another thing again.
That's right.
I grew up in the northwest of England, and when I was 17, my job was cleaning the cement out of the inside of cement mixer barrels at a tool hire place when they came back off hire. And the Monty Python, you were like the comedy Rolling Stones. We had cassettes and we'd put matching tie and handkerchief on.
And we'd recite
the cheese sketch.
Yeah.
In this very working class northwestern in Warrington Toolhire.
Yeah. Oh, Warrington.
So,
yeah.
So to have the appeal there, but then to also be able to do the Hollywood Bowl, you know. And,
well, so I think it embodies Python's certain attitude, which is kind of disrespectful towards most of the sort of establishment behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
And the nicest thing anyone ever said to me about Python was, well, when they watched Monty Python, they were unable then to watch the news. They just couldn't take it seriously. And I think that's very healthy.
Well, I don't think a newsreader has said enough for something completely different since.
No, but would you see what I mean? That when you start watching the news after Python, you start giggling at it because you see how silly it all is. Because, you know, everyone thinks, well, it's the news. No, it's not well thought out, the news. The main items now is somebody killed or not?
Yeah.
You know, 13 people were drowned and a ferry went down in Bangladesh, and then, you
know,
if
it bleeds, it leads.
Yeah, and it's all about these accidents. Well, this is not news. I mean, it is news for terrible news for the people involved. But there's nothing surprising about an accident. It's going to happen because we're human beings and we're very imperfect. And to make this the staple of our news broadcast is insane. I think the news people should just be given a good shaking up and told stop being so f***ing boring and be a bit more imaginative and try and put things up there that balance the good with the bad instead of being drawn inexorably to every bit of bad news there is. Everybody says, well, I'm so depressed watching the news. Well, it's hardly surprising when the people choosing the news only choose depressing news. Doesn't mean all the news out there is depressing. You know, sometimes you discover that the great things have happened, or people have done wonderful things, or this particular social experiment has worked, and that stuff should be out there too. There's a general feeling that the world is much, much madder. Sorry, that's American more angry. Much crazier is what I mean. Much, much more lunatic than people are supposed to say. Do you see what I mean? And when people watch Python and then can't take the news seriously, I think that's great, because they think on the whole we must not make fun of human pain, whether it's physical pain or psychological pain, but anything else we make fun of.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Oh, we've done an hour.
Well,
we?
Yeah, we have. I'm aware. I don't want to eat into your schedule because you're a busy guy.
My schedule is very simply, I'm going to a Chinese restaurant for dinner with my wife. So you know what I mean?
Well, that's important. I don't want you to be late for that.
That's very nice of you, but okay. I want to make sure you get enough for a program.
Okay, well then there are a couple of things I do want to cover.
Yeah, sure.
Before. The Guardian newspapers reported that you're in talks with the BBC to make another sitcom.
Yes, that's quite right. And I have been very rude about the BBC.
Well, I think you said they didn't know what... You think you said the commissioning editors didn't know what they were doing.
Oh, yeah, because you see, I used to be a huge admirer of the BBC. And that was in the day when the people who were heads of department and who went ahead and green-lighted programs had worked their way up through the system. And if you've been a floor manager for Ronnie Barker, you've learned a lot about comedy. You know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, 5 years of making programs with Ronnie Corbett.
Mm.
Or David Jason, you begin to learn about comedy. And then when you're the head of the organization, you know, Light Entertainment, you have a fair idea of what you're talking about. And then they went through a period of decades when they had these people called commissioners, they commissioned programs. They'd never written, they'd never acted, they'd never directed. How the hell are they supposed to know? Comedy's difficult. It takes people a long time to understand it. And here were these people who had no experience of it at all, but had been given a desk and thought, therefore, that they must understand it. And this wasn't my experience. This was the experience of young comics whom I'd worked with on shows, and they'd tell me this, and they'd say how depressed they were, and how they, these commissioners, or whatever they're called, they tried to micromanage everything when they had no idea what they were doing, and how it had taken all the fun and joy and creativity and bounce out of doing comedy. And that made me angry. Because the important thing with television is to find people of talent, as opposed to the Piers Morgans of this world, and see what they want to do to make people, to get people interested and amused. So that I was complaining on their behalf. And then about 6 months ago, one of my dearest and oldest friends who I met at Cambridge, let me get this right, in 1960, so I met him 56 years ago, he said, I want to talk to you about a TV series, the BBC. I said, go on. And he said, I found two really good people, Chris Sussman and Sean, somebody or other. I mistrust anyone who's called Sean. Apparently, well, he's Irish and Scots or something like that. And he said, these guys are really great. And I went along and I met Chris Sussman, and I thought, this is a lovely guy. And he understood the comedy. We started talking about it. I thought, God, he gets it. So Humphrey had been given a script, again written by an old friend of mine, who was a member of the Monty Python Repertory Company in Tunisia when we made Life of Brian all those years ago. What was that? I can't even think.
79?
Yes, released in 79, made in 78. And so Charles McKeown had written this, and I read it, and I thought, if we do this in a completely different style, I mean, as the absolute opposite of Faulkner, if we do this in the right style, I think it could be, in its own way, amusing and quite touching. Much gentler thing. I don't want to tell you yet.
Okay.
But it's very, very different. If people think it's going to be some knockabout comedy, it's the opposite. And so we are reading a couple of scripts to a couple of the moguls from the BBC, and I have no idea if these moguls have any idea what they're doing, in about a week's time. And if they like it, then they will commission a series, and we'll do a few shows in the spring. But I said, it's quite a delicate kind of humor, and my own opinion is it shouldn't be done with a studio audience, because people get anxious if it's subtle and the studio audience don't laugh and smiling. Do you see what I mean? It makes them anxious. And
so some type of a single camera thing.
I think so. I think it'll work much better, because the single camera thing can give you a little bit of intimacy that you don't get with the studio audience. Mm. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to that. And it's very nicely written. And you have no idea, almost everything I've ever done that people liked, I either wrote or co-wrote. Mm. The only exception to that really is Clockwise.
Yeah.
And I got three or four very, very nice parts in American films like Out of Towners and Rat Race. But most of the time, if I haven't written it, it hasn't done very well. You know,
yeah.
It's a shame. I was the lucky old Hugh Grant and with Richard Curtis.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well then finally, you've now got the Lifetime Achievement Award. You know why they give them to people. It's because you've reached a certain age.
I don't know why they give them to people, but I thought, well, that's very nice. And then I thought, well, I was told, well, Stephen Fry accepted it last year, and I thought, well, he's 20 years younger than I am.
Okay.
Have they found out something from his doctor that... So I thought it would be fun. And I put out a funny tweet. I said, I'm delighted to accept this award, firstly, because it will annoy Terry Gilliam, and secondly, because I'm humbled by the offer of an all-expenses-paid holiday in Berlin. And it was delightful. And the Germans, I really like Germany. Really, except for the autograph hunters.
The German autograph hunters are different, are they?
Very mercenary.
mercenary.
Well, I mean, the autograph hunters, the genuine ones, of course you saw it, but an awful lot of them take it away, put it on eBay and make $50.
Okay. $50. The ones with the
clipboards. Yes. Yeah, yeah. The one with the clipboards. Yeah, yeah. Clipboards. That's how you tell it normally. Yeah.
77 next month?
Yes.
What's on your bucket list?
What's on my bucket list? A lot more sitting quietly in a garden in the sunshine with my fabulous wife and cats and old friends. And I would like to travel much more, but I'd like to read things that I have read but only half understood. There are some extraordinary books out there at the moment. There's a book called The Black Swan. And several of these books have been out for some years. There's a book called The Drunkard's Walk about probability. There's some very, very good books about psychology. I mean, there's Daniel Hahneman's, Kahneman's Fast and Slow Thinking. And there's a book I just read which I think is quite extraordinary. I think the most important book I've ever read, actually. I know it's extraordinary thing to say. It's called The Master and His Emissary, and it's written by a man of astonishing accomplishment. He's not just a doctor and a psychiatrist, but he used to lecture on English at Oxford. And then he went to Johns Hopkins University, the medical department there, and studied neuroimaging so that he could see very clearly what activities inspired particular activities in part of the brain. You know, they can now see where the blood flow has increased when people do a particular job or task, thinking.
Is this the one where they show people images of things and something happens in their brain, but it happens before they see the image?
Yeah. That's part of what it's about. But it all depends whether you think that you are only your conscious. Because if you also think that you are your unconscious as well, which you clearly are, although people don't like the idea, then that problem doesn't exist, just goes away. But this book, written by a fellow called Ian, spelt the Scottish way, that's I-A-I-N, McGilchrist. I'm having lunch with him on Sunday for the first time. And I'm telling people about this book because it explains more about, I think, why the world's gone wrong recently. That we have two hemisphere brain, and you can now say, to some extent, despite the fact that it's tremendously interwired, you can say that parts of the brain do have a dominant role in these kind of things, and the other half of the brain has a dominant role in others. And we need a balance between the two hemispheres, and if one hemisphere starts dominating the other, which could happen in a whole culture, then things go a bit askew.
That's interesting, because you're like the living example of that, because you studied very logical things.
Yes.
Law, Latin, mathematics. But
got
also
into Cambridge on science, switched to law. Yeah.
But and the creative side didn't come out for you until Footlights.
But much later. Now I spent the rest of my life really fascinated by the unconscious and the fact that creativity only comes from the unconscious. In fact, I do talks and seminars about it, never in England, because I'm never asked, but in America and in Australia and in Europe, Northern Europe, a lot. And I get out and explain about creativity, because I think in a funny kind of way I understand it better than almost anyone else, because I'm also a bit creative. Now, the psychologists who've studied it, who've written fantastic things about it, but they're not actually creative themselves, most of them. Do you see what I mean? So I talk about it from the inside, and I think if I spend half an hour with anyone, I can make them more creative in half an hour.
John Cleese, thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure. The tour,
we are now shaking hands.
We're shaking hands for those who
can. On radio.
Yes, but I just felt like the right thing to do to thank you for your time. And
Want to say to my American friends, what the hell are we going to do, friends? How are we going to get out of this mess? And I want to leave with a question, not with some solution.
John Cleese, voted by you as the number one guest in 2016. Thanks for voting, and I hope that 2017 is your best year ever. Thank you for listening to London Calling in 2016. I got some great guests lined up for you in 2017.
Next time, it's part two of my chat with the American broadcaster who lives in Britain, Charlie Wolfe. In the meantime, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Graham Mac. If you want to hear more Mac Nuggets, check out my website, macmedia.co.uk, and you can subscribe to my Bob FM shows on iTunes. Got a question or something you'd like to say? Send me an email. Put your phone number in the email. I might call you back. I might Skype you. You might find yourself on the show. My email address is graham@macmedia.co.uk. And you spell Graham like the cracker, Mac like the truck. Till next time. Ta-da.